Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I am your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I am joined by his illustriousness, the Grand Hierophant of the Temple of Awakening Divinity, none other than Hal Lucius Nation, which of course is not his real name, but a very good friend of mine and is the person who first introduced me to the full 5-MeO-DMT experience. And he's here on the podcast today because he was part of the Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, an Anthology of Approaches to Serving the God Molecule book project. And the conversation that I'm bringing to you today here on the podcast is actually transcribed and featured as an appendix towards the back of the book. And the reason for that is that we already had an introductory chapter about the Temple of Awakening Divinity and its protocols and methodologies, as well as an introduction by Hal there, and that serves as kind of the opening of the book after my own introduction, the editor's introduction. So we had this great conversation. It was kind of the last minute thing that was coming for the production of this book, and we actually had the conversation just about a week before the book was finally released and published. So it was the last minute thing, and put it in as an appendix, and it's going to serve as a great introduction to the book here on the podcast. So we've got that conversation. Just to let you know a couple things about it, it is an ambient recording in the room, so it's not done through microphones and, you know, done through Skype the way that I'm normally doing interviews, and we get some ambient sounds, and every once in a while, Hal has a propensity to tap the table that had the recorder on it, so you might hear a little thump, thump, thump. And also, he's kind of a loud talker, so sometimes the audio sort of maxes out a little bit. So there are a few limitations there. But other than that, it's a good, clean recording and a very personal, very intimate conversation with Hal. So I hope you enjoy that. Of course, the book, Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, an Anthology of Approaches to Serving the God Molecule, is now available. It's out there at the various Amazon marketplaces. It's available in paperback, and it's also available through Kindle eBook. And for anyone who would rather just get that directly from me, if you are interested in receiving a PDF copy of the book, then I make that available to people for basically $10 PayPal. And then I send you the PDF. So if you'd like to get it that way, and that way you get all the color art. Of course, in the paperback, there's a lot of art, but it's in black and white. So if you get the PDF or get the ebook, then you can see all the art in color, which, you know, if that's important to you, yeah, get it in a digital version because the art's really cool. Of course, because, you know, I made it, so I think it's cool. There's going to be lots more about the book coming up on the podcast. I also have a conversation with Rak Razam that forms the basis for Rak's chapter within the book, which is not presented in conversation format, but we did do that as a conversation, and then he turned that into his submission. And so that's going to be coming up in the coming weeks on the podcast, and actually a little bit later this week, I'm going to be interviewing Rak Razam along with his team that he is building for their 5-MeO school that they are going to be facilitating down in Mexico this summer. So that, of course, is related to the book. It's not directly in the book, but he's got a team of people that he's working with, and they're all going to be on the podcast, and so we're going to be doing that. Then I have my conversation with Rak, and then there are other individuals who are featured in the book who have not yet been on the podcast. I'm going to be bringing them on for interviews as they are interested in doing so, and there are a number of people who want to do that. And I also have a backlog of other interviews that have been taking place, and I have a couple more coming up just this coming week. So kind of an overload of interviews over here at the Entheogenic Evolution, and it's going to take a while for all of it to come out. And of course, we still have a few more chapters of Orb Eyes Vision. So if we're all just patient with it, it's all coming out. And a lot of it is in support of this new anthology, Facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, which if you've already purchased it and read it, hope you enjoyed it. In terms of other announcements, I don't have anybody to thank this week because there have been no contributions made in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. If you would like to support this podcast, which is listener supported 100%, it's quite easy. Go by my personal webpage, martinball.net. use the PayPal link at the top right of the page, or join up as a patron over at my Patreon page. Everything from $1 a month with limited access up to $100 a month, which gets you an hour check-in or consultation video call once a month. Plus you get prizes or gifts, I should say, of different products with my art on it that comes to you, and, you know, other little perks and privileges. Also regarding facilitating 5-MeO, the book, LAMPS, the Los Angeles Medicinal Plant Society, is hosting an event this Thursday on May 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. to talk about the book. And I mean, I have to be honest, I'm a little bit skeptical about whether this event is actually going to happen, because LAMPS has tried to schedule things with me before, but because Symposia painted me as such a terrible, awful, psychopathic, evil person, that they've received a lot of pushback in the past from trying to include me in something. So we'll see if it actually happens. But there is a link for that at the Entheogenic Evolution page on Facebook if you want to go there and check it out and sign up for the event coming up this Thursday, May 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. Pacific time. And also, just to let you know, I've released a new EP of music. I'm actually really proud of these songs, and it's called When Nature Calls. It's currently exclusively available at my Bandcamp page. That's martinball.bandcamp.com. And you can also find the links to all my music at my webpage, martinball.net. And this is a collection of 4 songs, and each one is like an epic track. And it starts with whales that are recorded in Maui, and then frogs that are recorded here in Ashland and also in Florida, and also the call of a screech owl that's claiming its territory in my backyard. And I've created 4 epic tracks of music to go with these natural sounds. And I personally think it's a great listen. I'm going to put in the second track from that EP is going to come after my conversation with Hal in today's episode. And so anyway, you can check that out. It's available. It's out there through martinball.bandcamp.com. So that's all the announcements I have for today. I've been rambling on for a while, but just had a few things to share. Here's my conversation with Hal Lucius Nation, Grand Hierophant of the Temple of Awakening Divinity, where I first got my experience with 5-MeO-DMT way back in 2008, January of 2008. Here we go. Enjoy the conversation. Hi, Hal.
Yeah, that'd be Hal Lucius Nation.
So we'll just start at the top. How were you introduced to 5-MeO-DMT or Toad, and what was your experience? How did that happen for you?
So February 2nd, 2005, I was lecturing on my favorite topic of discussion at that point, which was the mystical unit of experience in, of all places, Las Vegas, Nevada, at a particular gathering of right around 150, 200 neo-pagans, alchemists, Wiccans, you know, spiritual folk. And I was lecturing on the mystical unit of experience from the perspective of the disciplines of Raja Yoga, ceremonial magic, hermetic Kabbalah, transpersonal alchemy, various forms of Tantra. Technically, I was considered a theoretical expert, yet I had never experienced a non-dual state or a unitive state of consciousness at that time, when a very dear, close friend of mine was standing out in back of the venue after delivering half of what was a 3-hour presentation with well over 100 PowerPoint slides. And he asked me if I trusted him. And I thought that was a really weird question. And I asked him why. And he said, well, because I want to show you the Holy Grail. And so at that point, every doubt hackle on my body stood on end, because having come through a Templaratic tradition, I knew something both metaphorically, mystically, mythologically around the Holy Grail. And I looked at him and I said, you're offering me a drug, aren't you? And he said, well, you did say you trusted me. And so at that point in my experience, in my life, I was about 8 years clean and sober. So I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder, because I had done a lot of white powders in my 20s and 30s and had some problems with them. And But I said, yeah, I did say I trusted you. And so he opened the door to his Burning Man bus, and I went on inside, and it was set up like a beautiful harem-style temple. And there were two sisters there, priestesses, who I knew well and trusted, and another gentleman who basically was a chiropractor by trade, who had done a lot of work with the Santo Daime tradition, kind of serving as the server. And they laid me down on this sumptuous bed, and they put this glass pipe that had a little bit of cannabis, which was one of my problem substances, with this very tiny, like a match head size pile of this white powder. And I looked down at it, and I looked at them, and I said, whatever that is, I don't think it's enough. And they laughed and chuckled and said, no, we think it's enough. So we're going to light this. We want you to inhale it, take it in, lay back, relax, and let go. And I looked at them completely confused. And I said, let go of what? I had no idea what they were talking about. But I listened to them, and they lit the pipe, and I inhaled its contents with kind of mixed reservations about blowing my sobriety. And as soon as my head hit the pillow below me, everything disappeared into essentially what I called velocity and a little bit of terror. And I was jettisoning backwards down a wormhole of light faster than the speed of light, thinking to myself, oh shit, you've done it now. And so my son, who I adore, was born 1 month and 1 day prior to that. And so as I'm jettisoning back down this wormhole of light, I realized their words where they said, just let go. But I didn't realize I was going to have to let go of everything, including my life as I knew it, because I was convinced that I was in this process of dying. And so in that moment, I accepted the experience and I surrendered into it. And in that moment of choice, everything exploded and imploded into what I like to refer to as everything all at once, forever, right now. And my consciousness expanded into the totality of all existence. There was no sense of myself. There was only the complete perfection of all existence that was culminating in a fully transcendent experience of love. And there is no way that I can even try to explain, but it was massive. And after what appeared to be some immeasurable period of time, some small little shred of my ego appeared in the vast recesses of cosmos. And somehow I knew that I was going to have to land the plane of my ego back onto the runway of my conscious awareness, my psyche, and my body. And it took what was then 15 years of my Raja Yogic training to actually land that plane. And I sat bolt upright with a huge gasp, laughing and crying simultaneously, saying, I knew it was real. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. You know, and what I meant was, I knew that this experience of union with God, union with source consciousness, what the yogins call a nirvikalpa samadhi, was possible while in a human physical vehicle. And the irony that that was brought on by the inhalation of a small, very small bit of white powder was not lost on my my recovering drug-addicted mind. And so, without going too much into the story about it, you know, after a short period of time, they kind of shuffled me off the bus and back into this essentially drumming and dance environment, you know, of this party that was going on. And I went home after that and went to sleep, woke up the next day looking at all my friends, and I said, did that actually happen? Because I doubted the veracity. It was so huge. And they said, yeah, that actually happened. And that set me on about a 2.5 year integrative process of deep diving into the academic and intellectual understanding of what I experienced. I hadn't really been into psychedelics that much before, but I then found the works of people like Jeremy Narby. I had Terence McKenna's books on my shelf. I went back and read Hoffman's work. I really did a deep dive back again into Aleister Crowley's work on processes of using these kinds of sacraments, which had been around for a while, found Huxley's work, and really just did a deep dive. And over the course of the next 2.5 years, tried to ground myself into an intellectual understanding of what it was that actually happened. During that time, I found James Orrock's first edition of Tryptamine Palace, which was very useful because I hadn't read anything about the substance because there was nothing published at the time. I also found Rick Strassman's DMT, the spirit molecule, which was helpful, but it really didn't, you know, it really wasn't talking about the substance that I had just done. And then 2.5 years later, I had another friend and one of the same two women that had showed up on my first occasion, who showed up at my home in Southern Oregon with my former partner. And he reached into a bag he was carrying and he pulled out this glass and brass device. And I immediately recognized it as an administrative tool for this medicine. And he said, "Do you know what this is?" And I said, "I think I do. I said, I believe that's the lamp of invisible light of the alchemists, the lamp that burns with neither oil nor wick," which had been talked about very extensively in the alchemical and magical literature. And he was a bit of an alchemist himself, and he looked down at the device, not realizing it, and he said, "You know, actually, I think you're right. It is exactly that. Would you like to help me calibrate it?" And of course, my hand immediately shot up, and we arranged to do a little bit of ceremony in our own temple space, at our home space, and I did the medicine for the second time. And in that particular occasion, my consciousness expanded into the vastness of the totality and singularity of all things. But as I was integrating in from the experience, I had a distinctly kinesthetic, but somewhat, you know, what I would call a archetypal download, where I experienced the goddess of infinite space and the infinite stars thereof in my tradition. Her name is Nuit, N-U-I-T. And I had been a devoted priest of hers for almost a decade before that. And she asked me if I was willing to take an oath to myself and her through the catalyst of this medicine to somehow go out and find the medicine. I had no idea how that was going to happen. And to create sacred ceremony and begin offering this to others. And not only did I agree to that, but I took an oath to that effect while I was under the influence of the sacrament. And as I came out, I had some vague recall, and I looked at my former partner, or my partner at the time, and our friends, and I said, "Did I just take an oath?" And they looked at me and said, "Yeah, pretty serious one." And my response was, "Oh shit, that's not what I was expecting, nor was it what I wanted to do." But I realized that I had taken this oath to the goddess that I had devoted myself to. And so over the course of the next few weeks and months, I really deliberated whether or not this was something that I was capable of doing. And it was clear that I was to do that within the tradition that I had already been raised in, which is the religious spiritual philosophy known as Thelema. And so I started composing the ritual. I acquired one of these lamp devices, which you tell the story of, and a really good story about it in the Entheogenic Evolution, because he didn't send me the lamp. He sent me this other contraption, which I think you described as having too many parts to possibly be useful. And then I finally got a lamp device. I ended up acquiring some Bufo alvarius toads online, believe it or not, from a company called Bouncing Bear Botanicals, something I would never do again because I don't believe that these animals should be taken out of their environment and that we really should protect them. And then on December 7th of 2007, I held my first official ceremony as the Temple of Awakening Divinity, or Toad. And then I met you, not fairly shortly thereafter.
Yeah, like maybe just a couple weeks.
Couple of weeks shortly thereafter, we had come into contact and communication. And Since that time, we have served almost 6,000 individuals. We've held well over 1,500 ceremonies, and we continue to offer this sacrament in a safe and responsible way to people really from all over the world.
So let me ask you, with the development of the ceremonial structure that you use, you know, and even recounting what you have in the book, that it seems like that pretty much most of the structure was already there by the time that you and I first met, which, as you say, is just a couple weeks into even just starting this. So how did you go about developing that structure? I mean, I know you say that it comes out of your pre-existing tradition that you were in. So it sounds like it was more of an adaptation and adopting that rather than necessarily creating it out of whole cloth.
Yes, exactly. In fact, I would really say that I cobbled it together. I use a formula of ceremonial magic, and I use a very specific technique that involves processes of induction, banishing, purification, consecration, check-in and invocation, and then initiation with the sacrament, and then a process of grounding in, and then integration that follows from there. So what I did is I took ceremonial aspects of liturgical, theurgical, and thaumaturgical techniques. Theurgy meaning, I call that working with God energy. Thaumaturgy, generally defined as miracle working, I call it the application of theurgy towards apparently miraculous means. And so through this ceremonial magical technique, which is where Leary got his ideas of set and setting that he and Metzner and Ramdas put into place, I just decided to take that a step further and go back to the original roots of that by creating a sacred ceremonial context that would give people a safe, solid, and sacred container within which then to be able to surrender fully into the expansiveness of the medicine. And so there are antecedent rites or rituals that exist that I then drew sections from to utilize in the ceremony, as well as crafting some of that on my own as well, in as it would apply appropriately. But I've really kind of honed that down to the minimum of what it can be, utilizing that contextual ceremonial framework.
So let me ask you this. Something that a lot of people comment on in their submissions to the book is this idea of, one, that many of us who have the experience, the immediate response is, oh shit, I've got to share this with as many people as possible.
Yeah, we call that the evangelical component.
Yeah, the evangelical component, the evangelical urge, and even phase that a lot of people go through.
Yeah.
And there's also a lot of commentary how that's not necessarily the best thing to follow through on immediately. And there's also the general advice, which I think that you would probably be more than happy to agree with, that for people who are facilitating, it's really important to see a lot of different presentations of how people respond so that you as a facilitator, you kind of get an idea, okay, one person might freak out, someone else might try and run away, someone else is going to strip off all their clothes, someone else might throw up all over themselves, right? So like if we only have a small sample, you know, like with me on from that very first experience, I was like, oh, this is what 5-MeO does. Right? Because I had the full bliss, ecstatic, non-dual experience, and I thought, it must just do this. But then as I kept coming back to Toad, I started to realize, no, this is the highest potential of it.
Yeah.
But this is not the automatic result.
Correct.
So I think that you definitely provide a very safe and secure format and setting. But just how do you respond now to that idea of, well, first you got to see a whole bunch of people and you've got to study with a bunch of different facilitators before you even ever think of giving this. And yours is also kind of unique that you kind of issued this oath while in state.
Right, right. So, well, and your next question here too is, how did you become a facilitator and why?
Yeah.
So I would definitely say I did not go seeking this out. In fact, there are some things that I learned much later was that there was an aspect of it where the medicine came looking for me. It came looking for somebody who would be its champion to a particular degree. And so I definitely, you know, did not set out with the intention of, oh, I'm going to be a 5-MeO-DMT facilitator. In fact, after the first occasion, the experience was so huge that I had to compartmentalize a good portion of it because I wasn't ready to, I really wasn't able to unpack it right there. I would still say I'm still unpacking some of the compartmentalized pieces of my first experience. And so to address that, you know, I believe it's in the best interest of anybody thinking of facilitating with this medicine to witness as many experiences as possible. In the Entheogenic Evolution book, you called them types of journeys, and you listed about, I don't know, 10 to 12,
yeah,
what I call archetypal presentments. They're how different people present. And each person reacts completely uniquely to the medicine experience, depending on their readiness, their willingness, and their ability to let go of the egoic function. A lot of it also depends on how the facilitation is being brought about. So my particular approach is to contextualize something, and then once the framework is contextualized and the sacrament, really the Eucharist, is delivered, to then step back and to be almost hands off to allow the person to fully express what is coming up and emerging for them. And the only time to really involve myself in that is if the individual needs what I call navigational assistance in that process. And then if so, I might use techniques of feathering, which I know you know about, to help move and clear energy. There may be some verbal coaching involved as minimally as possible. There might be a little touch coaching if I've already gotten consent from somebody that they're open to receiving touch beforehand. And so I will then gently, I won't even use the term guide, will provide a gentle sense of loving presence for the individual to be able to provide them with whatever they need within that context, but at the most minimal level possible, because I really feel it's up to them to fully surrender the egoic function. And that surrendering has to be a choice. It has to be done consciously, and it has to be done willingly. It cannot be forced upon another. So there are a lot of practitioners who will just kind of bludgeon people with huge amounts of the medicine, which A, isn't really helpful, and B, can actually be harmful in a lot of situations because it can bring on effective overdoses, which might then result in extended reactivations, even though those can happen to almost anyone. And so having worked with the medicine for over 15 years now, having witnessed as many people as I have, it starts giving you a broader overview of the full spectrum of experiences that you might be able to witness. And assisting people in whatever way they may need for them to willingly let go of the egoic function seems to really be at the core of what this work is about.
So let me go back and ask you kind of about this original calling, this idea of you were asking yourself through, and of course here we're speaking at the non-dual level, that you were asking yourself to be a vehicle to share this medicine with the world. And so back then at the time, you know, as you say, there were no books written about it.
No,
there was Auroch's book there, but that was the self-published, limited, unedited edition that he had passed out of Burning Man, and that was like the only literature that existed.
And I did get a self-published copy of that, which was probably the most helpful thing I had found to that point. Yeah.
But even there, that was a book that was given out to people as a gift at Burning Man, so it wasn't generally available to the public, and the full published version didn't come out until 2009.
Right.
So, and you and I kind of struck up sort of an interesting dichotomy in the sense that you were kind of the background guy, and I was the public voice.
Very much
about,
so.
About promoting this.
And, very much so. And you sat with me for almost a full year.
Yeah.
Well, and then started working with the Santo Daime at that point before you even started your own practice.
Yeah. So that came later. But now, people on the inside of the 5-MeO community, they know who you are. They know what your actual name is. But on the outside, you have still kind of maintained... You've been more public, but it's still been a bit more private.
Background.
Yeah. So, and we're also at a place now where we don't necessarily need a lot of more... We don't need more public champions. Because 5-MeO is spreading around. There's a lot of voices out there. But so how do you see... In becoming more public through the years, but still in background... And still conduct ceremonies, which my assumption is that you just want to continue doing this. And you've expanded into training programs and integration circles.
Working with organizations like Johns Hopkins, more recently Columbia University, to work with academia and science in bringing this forward. And in other ways, which I won't speak about right now, because that might tend to identify me.
Yeah. So we don't want to identify you, but I guess, so the question is, how do you see your role within the quote unquote movement? How has it changed over these past 15 or so years?
Wow. That's a question. So interesting to see the emotions coming up.
Yeah.
I've always considered myself a steward in this process, in that I recognized the importance of this crystalline key for opening up expanded states of consciousness. I'm being a little influenced right now because I just watched The Sunshine Makers last night, which is the story of Nick Sand and Tim Scully and their making of Orange Sunshine. And, you know, in that, just like myself, just like yourself, they were inspired by that particular medicine and effectively wanted to turn on the world and really took a lot of steps to go do that in a big way. So I recognize the potentiality of 5-MeO-DMT in its ability to open the consciousness of humanity to hopefully lead us to a worldwide transformation of the transcendent experience, to allow for humanity to wake up to the fact that we really are source consciousness embodied in flesh, and we can actually love one another, and we can actually have an environment that fosters peace and progress instead of constant war and, you know, and strife and all of these things that we're dealing with. You know, and again, perhaps I'm naive in this process, just as I look at Scully and Sands and seeing how they were naive, but it didn't stop them from trying. And so I recognized that this medicine, and I didn't even know that there was anything called a psychedelic community, you know, even happening at this time. But I saw that this was important and that it could be contextualized and offered to individuals to kind of maximize their experience. And the entire temple work was founded on a simple Taoist idea of from small things great. From a few people working very closely with a few other people, we could progressively expand this out to produce what I had hopefully saw as a 100th monkey effect that would have some kind of impact on the greater consciousness of society, of humanity. And looking at it now in hindsight, I can see that it actually is having an impact. It's just a little slower than I'd like it to be, perhaps. But that's my ego talking. And so I never sought out notoriety. I always kept my practice very, very focused and very, very centered on duty of care towards the individual who was in front of me. And that was what was really important. It's what remains most important. And to effectively optimize each person's experience as much as possible, which then led me to realizing fairly early on there needed to be an integrative component before anybody was offering integration in any way, shape, or form, before integration was even being talked about. And I recognized that the formula of essentially preparation, initiation, and integration was the essential model. And I've expanded that now to be preparation, including education and orientation, because you have to know where you are if you're going into this place that has no directions, that is, you know, literally omnipresent. You want to be oriented before you step into that, so that when you come out, you can find your direction, so you can navigate successively back in the ego consciousness world. And that's where I saw, as I started to learn, there were other practitioners out there who weren't offering any kind of integrative model at all, and were leaving people pretty disintegrated and imbalanced. And so I started offering those aspects fairly early in my practice, probably by 2000. I started in late 2007. Probably by 2009, I was already offering some kind of integration circle model.
So kind of related to that is the issue that now we've got really a lot of younger people are sort of stepping into this field and stepping into the role of wanting to facilitate or wanting to at least participate in some manner.
Yep.
Let alone have the experience. But again, sort of this emphasis that a lot of people go through this period of really wanting, especially if they've had a positive experience, they want to share that with others. And so maybe you've heard this yourself. I've had younger people refer to me as an elder in the community. And, you know, that's not necessarily how I feel personally, but you have been in this for a long time versus, you know, like some of the other people in the book, they say, well, I've been doing this for a couple months.
Right.
Versus you've got years. So what, within that, what do you feel is your potential role or responsibility, or it doesn't even have to be a responsibility, but what do you have to offer these kids who are getting into it out of, you know, really sincere enthusiasm, but as an elder statesman in the 5MEO community, kind of what do you see as your role or relationship, or what message would you want to share there?
So very clearly, two words: pace yourself. You know, the idea here is, you know, to quote Jim Morrison, I want the world and I want it now. And we all do. And the idea here is, you know, there is definitively a long arc that we are moving through in this process of global awakening. And 5-MeO-DMT represents kind of a wild card in that, meaning that it is extremely potent. And just as it can serve as an incredible catalyst for transformation, if not handled in a safe and responsible way, it can destabilize. And so people who are becoming enthusiastic, who have this evangelical component, which is really part of it. I know it was definitely for me. I wanted everybody to know about this. And I was much more exuberant about it in my early years. And I've learned to kind of curb my enthusiasm a little bit. Not because I'm any less enthusiastic. It's because I realize that it's just more prudent in terms of approach. And so I would say, do what you can to educate people about what this medicine is, because some people aren't really ready for this medicine. It's not right for everyone. And yet, anyone who desires to partake in it, it should really be considered their birthright. But there's also aspects of responsibility, of doing appropriate health screening, for example, both physical and mental health, before providing this medicine, which again becomes a very integral part of the preparation process that not a lot of people are doing. And so if people are thinking of serving this medicine, they really need to do their homework so that they're doing so in a responsible manner. And that means providing effective duty of care by doing appropriate health screenings before bringing people in, having integrative components, you know, to offer there, to find somebody who's serving this medicine and either see if you can develop some form of apprenticeship or if people are offering training modalities for this medicine. And there are a lot of very capable practitioners who are out there and doing these kinds of things. I had been approached by many, many people over the years who wanted to come in an apprentice capacity. And so I started allowing people to do that. But I found, even though I feel that shadowing and working within the context of serving people in a capacity of service is probably the best way to learn how to do this medicine. And yet there's even more to it than that, that has to go, that goes even deeper. In 2019, I started our Temple Acolyte training program and brought a cohort of 10 people through that training process. It was supposed to take a little over a year. It took a little over 2 years when COVID got involved with that. But we completed our first cohort in September of 2021, and we are now involved with our second cohort of trainees, bringing them through, and should be complete with them by the end of 2022. But that is a full year and a day program that requires intellectual and academic understanding of things, as well as practical approaches to the medicine, as well as people creating their own specific offering, meaning that the Temple of Awakening Divinity is not an orthodoxy. In fact, we're more an unorthodoxy than anything, because we don't believe in dogmatic and orthodox approaches. Once one has experienced the totality of God, you don't need a book, you know, to tell you about it, although books can be helpful. And when approaching offering this particular sacrament, and I'll use that term very specifically, there's a lot to learn. After 14 plus years of serving this medicine, I still learn every day by every single person that I offer this medicine. And one cannot become complacent in that. One needs to really always be recognizing that they are learning more about the depth of what this medicine can really offer, especially in applying it. And there are safer and responsible ways of doing that.
So just in looking over the questions that I've provided for people, I think that a lot of these questions are directly addressed in your protocols and methods document that we're featuring in the book. But I do want to ask you about something that is just a little bit ironic, and I just want your own take on it. That,
sure.
For one, you've got this great acronym, Temple of Awakening Divinity, which is TOAD. And as you have already articulated, that you did start out, that you had a couple of toads and you were milking the toads. But then you eventually moved on from working with the toads. So it was, you did begin with toad secretions.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I went to toad.
Because we had toads. And the second time.
No, the
second time was
we had the extract.
Oh, that was the Varola Theodora extract.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you are someone who's kind of interesting in the sense that you have facilitated and worked with toad secretions.
Yes.
You have also worked with organic extracts
correct.
From natural biological sources,
yes.
such as plants and grasses.
Yeah.
And you have also facilitated with synthetic lab-made pure molecule.
Yeah.
And this is an area where
a lot of controversy.
There is a lot of controversy and a lot of debate, and I think you and I are pretty much on the same page with this. But I would just like, what is your take on whether it should be toad or it should be organic, or if the idea that somehow synthetic is less than?
Right, sure. It's a big question, and it's one that seems to come up over and over again. Having worked with both what I call the organic medicine, which is the bufo toxin from the Sonoran Desert toad, I like to emphasize it's not venom. We shouldn't be calling it venom because it's inaccurate. Venom is something that is injected either by fangs or stingers. The bufo toxin, which is what it really is, or bufo secretion, is that. It is secreted by the toads. It's not an excretion, it's a secretion. And having worked with the toad secretion when I first started, there's definitely an aspect of it that has a qualitative difference that really needs the kind of expertise of almost a sommelier to really kind of tell the differentiation. My friend Dr. Joseph Pasurglia talks about an entourage effect, which is brought about by the over 100 different alkaloids within the bufo secretion, including its primary ingredient, which is bufotenine, which is 5-HO-DMT, which is found in every toad. Toads produce 5-HO-DMT pretty regularly, and that's been shown to have healing properties used in Chinese medicine for literally centuries. But it's only the Sonoran Desert toad that produces the 5-MeO-DMT, and there's some transferase process that's happening in the toad that converts the 5-HO-DMT into 5-MeO-DMT. So nobody really talks about that, and I think there's one reason why it's doing that, because there's one thing that the Sonoran Desert toad does that none of these other toads do, which is burrow down into the alluvial soils of the Sonoran Desert and going into a state of suspended animation for 9 months at a time in total darkness. So I actually believe it's this darkness component that is causing the toad to somehow, in its physiology, to transmute the 5-HO-DMT into the 5-MeO-DMT. Now, the 5-HO-DMT, the bufotenine, is actually the toxic component of the toad. And it's in more recent scientific studies, they found that it can be up to 35% 5-MeO-DMT, where before we thought it was only up to about 15%. So certain toads, depending on their diet, how healthy they are, produce more 5-MeO-DMT than others. And so usually when the toads are milked, most of the people who are extracting that will mix different animals' secretions to get a more homogenized form of the medicine. I've also worked with a number of different plant extracts, primarily one from Varola theodora, which is a woody resinous tree found in Central and South America. Varola is a member of the nutmeg family. Theodora, the name of this plant, Theo is God and Dora is gift. So whoever named that plant really knew what they were talking about. I also worked with some Phalaris grass extracts, but those are not optimal for a number of reasons. And I've worked with high-grade, lab-made, synthetic versions of what I refer to as the pure molecule. So over that time, having worked with all of these variants, I have found that I have preference for the pure molecule. Even though, you know, some people may have preference for other things, but I would say that all three of these variants do precisely the same thing. Because what we're talking about is the 5-MeO-DMT molecule itself and what it does. And what it does is allows for the ego to completely dissolve and for us to experience that which exists beyond the egoic structure. The other reasons I prefer working with pure lab-grade extracts, and everything that I work with is lab-tested, bioassayed by myself and a small cadre of people before giving it to anybody else, so we know that it's effective and we know it's not adulterated with anything else. I prefer working with that because it requires far less material. It's about a 7-to-1 ratio. So 10 milligrams of pure molecule is the equivalent of about 70 milligrams of the bufo secretion, but that's going to have 7 times more cardiovascular constrictors in it from the actual bufotenine. So just from a health and safety point of view,
I find that the pure molecule that's cleanly made is usually the best approach. Now, I'll take those medicines and I'll bring them into our ceremonial environment so that as we're working in ceremony, there is actually a spiritual charge, if you will, that's then brought into the medicine itself. Because a lot of people who may be producing these medicines may be doing so for any variety of reasons. And so we want to bring the substances in, the actual sacrament, and we want to attune them to the work that we're actually doing.
Okay. So something that's not on the list of questions, but I think is really relevant for you because you kind of fit into a special category here, is that you are running a quote-unquote temple.
Yeah.
And yeah. We are now in the era where, and actually this has been around before with Toad, where people have constructed churches around Toad as a sacrament.
Yeah.
And here we're talking about Toad secretions. And now we are in an era where we've got a number of lawyers who are actively working
really on good ones too.
Protections of entheogenic sacraments.
Yes.
And applying the Religious Freedom Restoration Act for exemptions to federal drug laws. So there's kind of a two parts to this question. And one is, I know that you have gone to great lengths to fulfill all of those requirements as would be expected by law. Yet, also, you are not looking to take the Temple of Awakening Divinity into a public forum, as some people have done in creating entheogenic churches. So
sure.
Sort of the question is, why not? Why keep it underground and private? And then just what then are your thoughts about the more public churches, which have not yet been tested in the court of law? I mean, we only have three exceptions right. thus
the
far. The Udine Bay,
the Santa Daime, the NAC.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, we can look at SoulQuest Mother Church of Ayahuasca,
which
failed, at least being recognized by the DEA. So the fact that we have governmental organizations like the IRS and the DEA determining who is a legitimate church and who's not, I find to be problematic to begin with,
yes.
from a First Amendment standpoint. You know, and then secondarily, there's a broader question. There's people who are actually doing religious spiritual work with this medicine, which I didn't see any other way to do it. It just, for me, I was already an ordained priest at the time that I started working with this medicine. I became an ordained bishop shortly thereafter, and I'm working within the context of my general spiritual tradition because in my, you know, some people would call it a conversionary experience. I call it a confirmational experience where through the entheogenic work, it just confirmed what I was doing. You know, within the context of, let's say, the Santo Daime with Maestro Irenaeu, they called that a conversionary experience where he experienced the Daime and he kind of converted from his strictly Catholic religion into this kind of hybridized piece. So it just became obvious to me that this was a religious spiritual experience, as it became obvious to you as a professor of comparative religions. And so I just didn't see anything else other than to do it that way. And then it was only later, really 2015, that we incorporated and we started, you know, putting all of the essentials of the 14 points that the IRS is looking for in bringing that forward. There's part of me that is still resistant in applying for 501c3 status. Because that, even having a corporation, a fictitious body that serves as this interface between the secular and governmental authority feels really inauthentic to me. I'm doing it because it provides a certain amount of potential safety, which could be an illusion. Because, I mean, it was an illusion for Santo Daime church leader.
Jonathan
Goldman. You know, when he came home to find a SWAT team surrounding his house and interrogating his children.
I cherish my personal liberty. I cherish the fact that I can live in a society that says its primary foundations are on freedom, liberty, and justice. But sometimes it doesn't feel that way. So I don't know that I want to be the poster boy for testing that. Now, there are others who are choosing to be, in recent years, far more face out than me. If they would like to undergo that ordeal, they are welcome to do so. If I have to undergo that ordeal, I will, but I'm not personally choosing it. Because my work is best done with me free and bringing this to as many people as possible who choose to partake in it. Because I can't do my work inside of a prison cell. No. And so I'm choosing not to. And do I believe that the laws around this are unjust? Yeah, I actually do. And slowly but surely, especially here in Oregon where we are, we're starting to see that change very, very slowly. And there seems to be a momentum in this thing that we're calling the psychedelic renaissance or the entheogenic reformation that is allowing for these ideas to be brought out. And then you have people who are testing this, like the Soul Quest Mother Church of Ayahuasca, whose DEA exemption was denied, and yet it's my understanding they are still operating.
Yeah. So in your own personal case, if there were a test case that went forward with a 5-MeO-DMT church that was successful, let's say they go to court, and just like here with the Santo Daime, though even there with the Santo Daime, we have this bizarre case where in the court case itself, they presented the court-related fiction that Santo Daime is only happening in Oregon, and so we're only talking about churches in Oregon, and we're only talking about the religious right to consume Daime or ayahuasca in churches in Oregon, and they had to present this fiction that there aren't Santo Daime churches across the United States.
Correct.
Which there are. But anyway, so it became a very limited test case because they did win, but they only won in Oregon. But let's just say a 5-MeO church does go to court and it gets recognized, and it perhaps opens up the implication that this is not just limited to one particular state or one particular area, but that the federal government says, look, we can make an exception for 5-MeO-DMT because it does fit the category of a religious sacrament. If other people were to be that test case, which I know you don't want to be.
Not if I don't have to be.
Would that inspire you to go above board and be public? Or would you prefer to remain more in the background, even if it looked like things would go positively for you?
I would love to be able to be more forthcoming and transparent with what I'm doing. But just like the early Christian churches under the dictates of Roman authority, you know, that could cost you your life, or at least your freedom. And it wasn't until, you know, Christianity was accepted and brought on board by, into what turned into Roman Catholicism, which is a very different form of Christianity than the original Gnostic sects that started it. And so, you know, I'm wary of that because I'm wary of institutionalizing something that it has no place within the context of secular or governmental authority. Now, do I believe that it's a good idea to have some forms of regulation to make things safe? Abso-fucking-lutely. Absolutely. You know, but is that best instituted by the Drug Enforcement Agency? I don't know. I don't think so. So the thing is, you know, the government seem to be worried about the unraveling of the fabric of society because people are using these substances. Well, I got news. The fucking fabric of society is tattered and crumbling before our eyes, and it has nothing to do with people using entheogenic and psychedelic substances. It has everything to do with the fact that we are trying to control humanity, that corporate culture is absolutely out of control, and that we are not looking out for the commons of the people, and that we are basically selling ourselves to corporations and not really stewarding our planet in a way that's going to allow for our children and their children to potentially be able to survive. That we are clearly on a spiraling course to potentially a sixth extinction event. And if we don't wake up to that really, really quickly, it's not going to be fun over the next 100 years.
Yeah. And kind of the core of this issue at the very personal level is that people like you and I, by the standards of authority, would both be classified as outlaws. And both of us are members of our local community. We are parents. We are raising kids. We are not outlaws. We're not anarchists. We're not, you know, we're not out there causing trouble or anything.
We kind of want the world to be a better place.
Yeah, we want the world to be a better place. So I guess with that in mind, you know, I think we've covered most of the bases here, but just what would you want kind of your final message to be as someone who facilitates, as someone who is an ordained priest, as someone who is a father, as someone who is my dear, dear friend? What would be your final thoughts on all of this?
Be kind to one another.
Mm.
Celebrate your life, because it's the only one you get. One precious life. That's all you get. And if you recognize that we're here because Source chooses consciously to not only embody within us, but to embody as us. That Source has created you as a unique expression of itself, and there will be no one like you again, ever. And that is a precious gift. And to use our lives to celebrate that gift with others by making life itself better for those around us. That's what I believe the message of this sacrament is, the message of Source is a message of love, ultimately. And that it is only love that we can rely on to bring us through into this, into recognizing that we live on a paradisical planet, literally on a paradise in physical reality, that heaven, if such a thing exists, is right here. It's not someplace else. Because when we shuffle off this mortal coil, when that physical body dies and perishes into dust, when the thing that we've always known ourselves to be disintegrates and we merge into that infinite and eternal totality that knows it's the only thing that exists forever consciously, and that it embodies itself as an act of love so it can experience itself as other, when you recognize that, it's not going into that state that it's a miracle. It's recognizing that we're embodied in physical incarnations, that we have this opportunity to love each other here, now, that is the miracle.